This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran says United States needs to commit to clear action steps if it genuinely wants an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal. North Korea's leader heats up the rhetoric against the U.S. in a speech on the Korean War armistice anniversary. And dozens of former American officials are planning to form a third political party to break the bipartisan dominance of U.S. politics. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister has reiterated Tehran's determination to reach a good and durable agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark at a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Amir Abdollahian said a good agreement would be at hand if the American side took realistic steps in that direction. Iran's top diplomat said if the U.S. is really willing to clinch a deal with Iran, it must prove this in practice. Amir Abdollahian also touched on Borrell's proposed text for an agreement to revive the JCPOA, saying that Iran welcomes continuation of talks and diplomacy. Borrell, for his part, said the Iranian side has so far proven its serious resolve during the JCPOA revival talks, and it's time for those talks to bear fruit. This came a day after Borrell wrote in a Financial Times article that he has put on the table a draft agreement to revive the JCPOA. He said the proposed text addresses the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and some other remaining differences. Well, Masood Shajad, head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits from the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit for tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
Now to Ukraine, where the Russian military has taken the country's second-largest power plant. Ukraine has confirmed the capture of the plant in the eastern Donetsk region, calling it a tiny tactical advantage for Russia. Kiev also says that Russia is redeploying its troops to three southern regions, Melitopol, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. An advisor to the Ukrainian president says that redeployment seems to be a switch from offense to strategic defense. Ukraine has already said it intends to recapture Kherson, which fell to Russia in the early days of the war. The country also says its forces have killed dozens of Russian troops in the past 24 hours. The Ukraine war is now in its sixth month. Ukraine says that it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to revive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accused Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with the pipeline for gas supply cuts.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying, but the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK.
At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess.
It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, the UK's summer of discontent continues with yet another major rail strike over pay, jobs and working conditions, bringing widespread delays and cancellations. It comes a month after London subway workers staged a 24-hour walkout, prompting transport chaos in the capital. Syed Putuza reports from the British capital.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head to head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
But I love the railway. I love to travel by train. I want to keep doing it. And I don't want to keep thinking, oh, God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
Well, I totally get why they're striking. Obviously, it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new prime minister. Saeed Purizat, London.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country is ready to mobilize its nuclear war deterrent and is prepared for any military clash with the U.S. Kim was speaking at an event marking the 69th anniversary of the Korean War armistice. He also warned that South Korean administration and military could be annihilated if it makes what he called dangerous attempts. Kim's speech came after Seoul and Washington said that Pyongyang had completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. South Korea also said the North could face more sanctions if it conducts the test. North Korea says its nuclear program is for self-defense against threats posed by the U.S. and its regional allies. Pyongyang is particularly opposed to joint war games by Washington and Seoul.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea's further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Dozens of former U.S. officials, both Republican and Democratic, are going to announce a third national political party. They say the new party will appeal to millions of voters dismayed with the country's, quote, dysfunctional two-party system. The new party, called Forward, will initially be co-chaired by a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former Republican governor of New Jersey. The founding members hoped the party would become a viable alternative to the Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is being formed by a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years as a reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. A Gallup poll last year showed a record 2/3 of Americans believed a third party was needed. No information has been released on policy of the party, which will be centrist. Academic and political analyst Alexander Ozodagon says many American politicians are corrupt no matter what a third party comes into existence in the country.
In the 2016 election, Trump got around 63. I'm rounding the numbers up. Around 63 million votes, and Hillary got 66 million. So more important than third parties or fourth parties is how our politicians, corrupt, many of them, like you said, in the pockets of lobbies, how our politicians would somehow, maybe not this time, but definitely a priority in the future, to come up with some kind of a constitutional amendment to get rid of this gerrymandering, which results in this outdated and to some extent racist electoral college system. And just like the rest of the so-called democratic world, we go into a popular vote system. Now, if that happens, the Democrats will win. Kierkegaard said, the Danish philosopher, that life must always be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. Let's not forget, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George Bush in the 2000 election. And imagine if Al Gore became the president. I mean, 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, everything would have been possibly different. And Hillary got 3.5 million more votes in 2016, but because of the electoral college system, it didn't count.
When it comes to U.S. weapons sales, it's not just about profits. Washington's foreign policy initiatives should also be counted as can be seen in its deals with countries in West Asia. But the U.S. aggression against China is another reason, which may explain why it's planning to sell almost $1 billion worth of arms to Japan and Singapore.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Rajiv Sial, Ben Quinn and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Truss and Sunak Trade Blows in Acrimonious First TV Debate. The battle to become Britain's next Prime Minister descended into fierce clashes on Monday night, 25th of July, as Rishi Sunak launched repeated attacks on the economic policies of the favourite, Liz Truss, in their first head-to-head television debate. The two Conservative leadership hopefuls traded blows over tax cuts, over China and inflation, with the former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, accusing the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, of seeking a short-term sugar rush by cutting national insurance. Liz Truss accused her former cabinet colleague of raising taxes to their highest level for 70 years. The exchanges at the BBC debate followed a weekend of deeply personal attacks, with Sunak criticised over his wealth and his wardrobe, as Liz Truss faced claims she was economically illiterate while being reminded that she was formerly a Remainer. Rishi Sunak, widely seen as having to make up crucial ground to win over the Conservative membership, who will vote on 5th of August, repeatedly described his opponent's plans on the economy as not conservative, interrupting her at one point to say, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfounded tax cuts, £40 billion more borrowing. This is the country's credit card. It's our children and grandchildren, everyone's here, who are going to have to pick up the tab for that." Liz Truss hit back over Rishi Sunak's calls for a tougher stance on China, pointing out that the Treasury just last month was calling for closer bilateral and economic ties. Rishi Sunak accused his opponent of making pronouncements about a golden era between China and Britain. "I think that was almost a decade ago," the Foreign Secretary snapped back. Amid reports that Boris Johnson has not yet ruled out a political comeback, despite pledging to step down next month, both candidates also ruled out a role for the current Prime Minister in any government they might lead. "I'm sure he will have a role. I'm sure he will be vocal, but he will not be part of the government," said the Foreign Secretary, despite emphasising that she had been an early supporter of Boris Johnson's. She contrasted her continuing loyalty to him to those of others, adding that it would have been a dereliction of duty not to remain in her post. According to the Daily Telegraph, Boris Johnson told Lord Cruddas at Chequers over lunch on Friday that he wants to fight the next general election as leader of the Conservative Party. Lord Cruddas confirmed. Lord Cruddas is running a campaign to give Conservative Party members a vote on whether to accept Boris Johnson's resignation as Tory leader. But Downing Street responded by insisting that Johnson will leave the post when a new leader is chosen. On Boris Johnson, Liz Truss told the debate, "Having spent time with him this week on foreign affairs, I very much suspect that he would not want a future role in the government. He needs a well-earned break." Rishi Sunak, whose resignation from cabinet on the same day as Sajid Javid precipitated the ousting of Boris Johnson, paid tribute to Johnson as remarkable, but said he had reached a point where enough was enough. "I thought all the things that were going on the conduct side, were not right. And we clearly had different views on the economy side," he said. But with postal ballots set to arrive on Tory members' doorsteps by 5th of August, Rishi Sunak faced pressure to use the BBC debate and another hosted by Talk TV and The Sun on Tuesday to make an early breakthrough. Although he comfortably won the leadership race among Tory MPs, Liz Truss is the favourite to win after a series of opinion polls and surveys put her firmly ahead with party members. Perhaps as a result of this pressure on Rishi Sunak, the debate was particularly bad-tempered, with the former Chancellor often interrupting Liz Truss. At one point she said, "Under my plans, we would start paying back the debt in 3 years' time, so I'm not putting it on the never-never." The former Chancellor interrupted, saying, "That's simply not right," adding, "You promised almost £40 billion of unfunded tax cuts. That is the country's credit card." Liz Truss hit back, saying, "Rishi, that is not true. Under my plans, we would start paying down the debt in 3 years' time. COVID was a 1-in-100-years event. No other country is putting up taxes at this moment." The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has described Rishi Sunak's policies as contradictory. In the aftermath of the debate, supporters of Liz Truss argued that Sunak's interruptions were a result of his entitled background. "He came across like a public school mansplainer," said one. One Sunak supporter claimed that Liz Truss did not understand the economy. She was once again out of her depth, the MP said. Conservative Party grandees spoke out in the hours before the debate, pleading for both parties to resist from trashing the brand. But the tensions that have been building continue to manifest themselves, with Liz Truss declining to distance herself from comments by a supporter, the Culture Secretary Nadine Dorries, who outraged some fellow Tory MPs by comparing Rishi Sunak's Savile Row suit and Prada shoes to Liz Truss's £4.50 earrings from Claire's Accessories. "I'm not going to give Rishi fashion advice. I mean, I have said he's a very well-dressed man. I'm not going to give him fashion advice," said Liz Truss, when challenged about Nadine Dorries' comments. Lord Maud, the former party chair and minister for the Cabinet Office, had told the BBC's PM programme ahead of the debate, "One is obviously going to win the leadership, but if the behaviour of the teams and their language has been uncontrolled and it has damaged the party's standing or the way people see the party, then it could end up being a Pyrrhic victory." He said that the increasingly fractious tone of interventions from the campaign teams over the weekend had begun to appear like a race over who can sound more right-wing, as if that's the only game in town. Allies of Rishi Sunak said it was no secret that he had to make a significant impression in the debate, with opinion polls suggesting he's trailing his rival. But one campaign source said the polling from both YouGov and Conservative Home showed a wider gulf between the candidates than they had detected, and said many members were currently undecided. Liz Truss has strictly limited her broadcast appearances and has thus far declined to be interviewed by veteran political journalist Andrew Neil, who will go head-to-head with Rishi Sunak on Friday. Channel 4 said it was still hoping to convince Liz Truss to take part. Allies of Rishi Sunak have suggested he will take numerous broadcast opportunities in order to highlight one of his own strengths versus Liz Truss's perceived weakness. In previous multi-candidate debates, Liz Truss has polled badly with the general public, whereas Rishi Sunak came top in one debate and second in another. Earlier on Monday, 25th of July, Sunak teased his rival with a tweet, "Just me then," and a wink as Channel 4 announced the interview with Andrew Neil. Liz Truss's refusal echoed that of Boris Johnson, who refused to be interviewed by Andrew Neil during the 2019 general election campaign. Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss will take part in another head-to-head debate on Talk TV on Tuesday night and face off again at the first of members' hustings in Leeds on Thursday night.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yemeni men, firm faith. Part 1.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. On June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Ali Abdullah Saleh ruled Yemen for 3 decades. Before that, he was the president of North Yemen for many years. This is the museum he established to mark his own presidency after he resigned. His resignation did not mean that he wouldn't return to Yemen's political arena. Saleh had surrendered during the revolution in Yemen and delegated power to Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi and left the country for the U.S. under the pretext of medical treatment. On February 19, 2014, UN envoy Jamal Ben Omar announced that Saleh could take part in the upcoming elections in Yemen. At that time, Saleh was pursuing his own goals and got closer to the Houthis to make a unity with them. In terms of tribal divisions, the Houthis are Zaydis, just like him, and more importantly, they're considered Yemen's main power. If he sought a future in Yemen, he had to form an alliance with the Houthis. The coalition was eventually formed on August 10, 2016, between the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh. The coalition was aimed at putting up a resistance front against Saudi raids. Parts of the Yemeni army still took orders from Saleh. The Houthis needed his power for the war. Saleh, too, needed the Houthis' influence in order to regain power. As long as they could find a solution for the Saudi attacks, it was a win-win situation for both sides. But the Ansarullah leader didn't trust Saleh that much. He had to choose either of the two. Mohammed bin Salman, an ambitious Saudi young man who had launched an invasion on Yemen with all of its force on the one hand, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, a Yemeni dictator who was ready to join him in the fight against Saudi Arabia for now. October 8, 2016, some horrifying news from Yemen left the world in shock. Saudi forces bombed a funeral ceremony. 155 people were killed and 525 people were wounded. The number of fatalities on that day was more than half of the fatalities during the first 2 months of Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Gradually, public opinion in the world sympathized with the Yemeni people. Images from Yemen were the most horrifying images in the world. However, Houthi revolutionaries were under immense pressure.
لم تكن شكوك السيد عبد الملك الحوثي خاطئة. سرعان ما توضح.
There was a good reason why Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, was so hesitant. Soon, it came to light that Saleh was hand in glove with the Saudi-led coalition. The United Arab Emirates was supposed to play a secondary role in the war, a country behind Saudi Arabia. But UAE officials pursue their own aspirations. They know that Saudi Arabia is dreaming about becoming the regional leader and historically consider countries like the UAE as part of their own land. Saudi Arabia started a power game in Yemen, but the UAE was after business. In 2006, when the war in Yemen hadn't broken out yet, and Ali Abdullah Saleh was still Yemen's president, they signed a contract to construct a city named Al-Nur, or the City of Light. After the war broke out, Emiratis built prisons of their own. Some people were reportedly tortured in the prisons. However, it was always the UAE's humanitarian aid convoys in front of the cameras. The Emiratis had learned something that Saudi Arabia hasn't even started to think about. The UAE views the countries in the region the same way the colonial UK viewed regional countries. Saudi Arabia is after attacking, occupation, and capturing the region just like a traditional government. But the UAE is after business. And it doesn't make any difference for it whether it was going to achieve this goal through prison and torture or humanitarian aid convoys. The important thing is to push things forward, especially since Yemen's energy resources, including its oil and gas, are still intact. For companies, the temptation is so big that they will even get involved in bloody games. From November 28, 2017, the streets in Sana'a were scenes of clashes between Saleh loyalists and the Houthis. On December 2nd, Saleh appeared on Yemen's state television and called on the people to wrest back the country's control from the Houthis. What had happened? Why did the alliance between Saleh and the Houthis end so quickly in a year? The Houthis answered the question 2 days later. On December 4th, 2017, Mohammed Abdul Salam, the Houthi spokesman, told Al Jazeera that Saleh had clandestine ties with Saudi Arabia and certain other Arab countries for 3 months. Saleh seemingly sided with the Ansarullah resistance, but he negotiated with enemy representatives behind the scenes and was ready to make a peace deal with them. For Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Saleh was a traitor. The street clashes by Saleh's supporters to occupy the Houthis' headquarters failed. It was strange that no domestic force could defeat the Houthis. And the big question was, if the Houthis were merely a tribal group with no relevance to the national will in Yemen, and if they didn't enjoy support from the Yemeni people, why was it so hard to defeat them? The easiest answer for bin Salman was to point the finger at Iran. Iranian officials never denied that they were supporting the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni people, even though the support is mostly spiritual. At the same time, Iranian officials are pessimistic about bin Salman's aspirations. Bin Salman doesn't have sufficient experience to lead a region, and his short record in Yemen doesn't promise a bright future. People in Yemen are in a very tough situation. On April 21, 2015, when Saudi Arabia announced that it would temporarily halt its military operation, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman welcomed the Saudi decision because if the military operation did continue, the famine and disease in Yemen would become more widespread. International media spread the news. Western parliaments hit out at their governments for selling arms to Saudi Arabia. After a short ceasefire, Saudi Arabia resumed its heavy airstrikes. While the international image of the Saudis has been tarnished because of its heavy bombardment of Yemen, the Emiratis were secretly pushing their own agenda. They trained 35,000 Yemeni forces in Aden and other areas. They also had a plan for this strategic island named Socotra. Yemeni military forces on the island are trained by the United Arab Emirates. With their petrodollars, the Emiratis had bought mercenaries from other parts of the world as well. 1,800 paid militants from Colombia, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, and 400 mercenaries from Eritrea. It also bought off the heads of the tribes. Its influence also caused Riyadh's anger. Muslim Brotherhood is one of the oldest Islamic political parties in Egypt. Later on, it attracted many supporters in other Arab countries. They want the return of Islam in the face of nationalist and communist elements. Such parties are called Brotherhood. In Yemen, there was a brotherhood party called Islah Party. Saudi Arabia supported it, but the UAE was against it. It was clear what they were going to fight over next. In Yemen's traditional society, half of the people aren't Zaydi Shias, they are Sunnis. Brotherhood supporters seek to find a bastion among the Sunnis. More extremist groups like Al-Qaeda also try to recruit forces within the social context. The majority of Sunnis in Yemen are not inclined towards radical groups like Al-Qaeda, so brotherhood parties like Islah have a bigger chance. After the chasm opened wider, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi deposed two of his officials who had ties with the UAE. It was obvious that the Saudis were behind it. The UAE-affiliated groups formed a transitional council and announced if Hadi does not resign, they'll topple his government within 7 days. bloody infighting among anti-Houthi forces started, this time between UAE supporters, named the Southern Transitional Council, and Saudi supporters, namely Hadi and his forces. After Hadi's palace was besieged by the UAE-backed rebels, the clashes ended with mediation efforts, but it was clear that the Saudi project in Yemen was heavily defeated. The Emiratis had thrown down the gauntlet. They thought they could defeat the Houthis within 2 weeks, but now they were wasting $1.3 million every month for an endless war, and they had to flex their muscles to their partner, namely Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman had just realized that the differences within the coalition were serious. Forget about defeating the Houthis, large cracks had appeared within his coalition. During this period, Iran secretly provided Yemenis with food and medical supplies. Because Saudi Arabia had laid siege on Yemen, and the chances for food supplies, especially from Iran, are next to nothing. But food supply wasn't enough. If Yemenis couldn't defend themselves, the humanitarian situation in Yemen would further deteriorate. In an interview with a Chinese television network on October 1st, 2019, General Mohammad Baqiri, a high-ranking Iranian military official, spoke of Iran's advisory assistance to Yemen. در مورد یمن خب راه‌های یمن کاملاً مسدود هست و امکان کمک به اونجا به شکل تجهیزات و تسلیحات وجود نداره لذا این که گفته میشه از جمهوری اسلامی ایران موشک حمل میشه به یمن دروغه و وقتی بسته کوچک دارو امکان حملش نیست چطور موشک‌های چند متری امکان حملش باشه اما کمک مستشاری و فکری ما به ارتش مردمی یمن صورت میدیم و ما در کنار مردم یمن خواهیم بود تا اینکه بتونن این تجاوز را از کشورشون دور کنن. Yemen has the second biggest army in the Arabian Peninsula after Saudi Arabia in terms of the number of forces. The Yemeni army dates back to World War I and the independence of North Yemen. It means it's older than any other army in the peninsula. But the problem of the Houthis isn't the number of forces. The war imposed by Saudi Arabia is unequal. The Saudis buy the latest U.S. warfare at exorbitant prices, but Yemen is a poor country. The solution was to somehow tip the balance to make it an equal war. It means Yemenis should be able to take advantage of being Saudi Arabia's neighbor and threaten Saudi interests by making indigenous missiles.
The failure by global policymakers to act decisively to address the climate emergency threatens to erase decades of progress in the fight against childhood malnutrition in the global south, according to a new study by researchers at Cornell University. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Extreme Heat Could Wipe Out Decades of Gain in Fight Against Child Malnutrition. A study shows. Here's more. The failure by global policymakers to act decisively to address the climate emergency threatens to erase decades of progress in the fight against childhood malnutrition in the global south, according to a new study by researchers at Cornell University. The study shows that children in low-income countries are increasingly suffering from both acute and chronic malnutrition as their communities experience the effects of extreme heat, which is becoming more prevalent and severe around the world as fossil fuel extraction persists and carbon emissions rise. Sylvia Blum, who earned a PhD from Cornell University in 2021 and led the study published earlier this month in the Journal